Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 38, Don't Swallow That Phone.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiT. And by the new Ford Sync, featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation. All voice-activated from Ford Sync. For more details and to enter to win a free Nano or Zune, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to This Week in Law. This is episode 38. We're recording on Friday, November 13th. And you have come to the right place if you are one of the strange type of folks that we have on the show with us who enjoy thinking about internet law and technology law almost all of the time. If you're one of the folks who, like me, find yourself musing in the shower about whether Fox went ahead and got permission from General Foods to use Cheerios to call their cheerleading team that in the show Glee, and that occupies your time while you're getting ready in the morning, then you're right where you should be, and this show hopefully will be right up your alley. I'm here with our regular crew of characters, Evan Brown from internetcases.com. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Denise. How's it going?
Going well. Good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
And Colette Vogel from VogelLaw.com. Hi, Colette.
Hi, how are you guys? Nice to be here.
Doing great. Hey. Thanks for coming back. And Ernie Svensson from ErnieTheAttorney.net. Hi, Ernie.
Hey. Good to be back.
Great to see you. So housekeeping things before we get underway. We have a wave for the show per usual. And I got a nice message from Google today. They must be opening up their customer base or user base for Wave, because I actually have 8 invitations to give away finally. So if you are in need of a Wave invite, ping me, Denise, at twit.tv, and I'll give them away to the first 8 listeners who do that. But our Wave for this show is at denise.howell.net/wave38. You can also join us in the chat if you're listening and watching live at live.twit.tv. IRC.twit.tv is the chat there. We also have a friend feed chat going at denise.howell.net/twill38. So come on in and participate with us during the show. And we're really thrilled to have you giving us feedback and questions as we go through the stuff that we're going to talk about today. And Ernie, I have to lead off with this story that you suggested for us, which I haven't looked at too closely, and I just want to hear about from you. But the headline is, the DWI motorized Lazy Boy chair is gone. What gives you?
Yeah, I was very distraught by that. Well, anytime I see motorized Lazy Boy chair involved in a DUI incident, that kind of, you know, perks me up. And this one was basically, this is a Seinfeld episode, basically. Apparently, this fellow gets arrested driving the souped up chair. It was not a Lazy Boy chair. It was, so that's the first problem. But the city confiscated it, I guess, because he didn't pay the fine or whatever, and they then put it up for sale or for a bid on eBay, and they were going to get, I think, $30,000, but then it turned out that the Lazy Boy attorneys found out about it and said that they were auctioning without a trademark, without proper trademark authority. And so they had to take it down and start the auction over without the Lazy Boy name. And so they made a lot less money because of this intervention by the trademark lawyers. It seems to me it wasn't so much a trademark problem as a misrepresentation problem because, you know, of course, Lazy Boy would be the finest, you know, motorized chair if you could get one. And this one wasn't a Lazy Boy chair. So I think that was the real problem in this case.
So it was not a Lazy Boy chair, and yet they were calling it that, and Lazy Boy took umbrage.
Yeah, the city took license. I guess somebody in the marketing department got overly enthusiastic and thought, well, if we give it a specific name and we call it a Lazy Boy, that will get more attention. And I guess it did because, you know, the second time around, it didn't attract as many bidders.
And you can kind of see their point on that. I mean, Lazy Boy's point on that, it's, you know, sure, it's kind of obnoxious that they had to get involved with that. But that's one of those terms that the brand owner's probably a little bit worried about, this notion of genericide. You know, that is a mark becoming so commonly known in, you know, in connection with, you know, the goods, that they're afraid that it would just become the common term for a mechanical reclining chair. So I kind of see where they were coming from on this, even though it was a little bit, you know, kind of a spoiled, it rained on the parade a little bit, you know, not nearly as fun afterward.
Yeah, poor Proctor, Minnesota. Apparently they were $30,000 poorer than they would have been if they had been able to get away with the Lazy Boy moniker.
Well, then I heard the winning bidder actually didn't come up with the funds after all of this. Someone pinged me that on Twitter. Mm. I have not followed up. But
maybe they were drunk.
That would just make it the ultimate Seinfeld episode, right?
From bad to worse.
Yes. Well, another thing that seemed to go from bad to worse, as I understand it, is for all you football fans out there, Larry Johnson was using his Twitter account to have a heated exchange about, was it the other team's coach, his coach? I don't know
his
what
coach.
He was on. His coach. He was definitely grouchy and using some things on Twitter that could definitely be construed as homophobic slurs and just not really being a nice guy in his Twitter account. And ultimately, although people have since contacted me to let me know that, and I'm not familiar with the man's work as a football player, but that too was suffering. But this might have been the straw on the camel's back that made it fall, because shortly thereafter he got the axe. So it's yet another person losing their job over an action on a social media site. Anybody have any thoughts about poor Larry?
Thank God I didn't have him in my fantasy football team.
One of the more interesting things about this is that it wasn't just the tweet itself and what the team thought about it, but, you know, in this article in Mashable that we were sending a link to earlier this week, said that the petition, fans kind of wanted him gone, 32,000 signatures on a petition to get rid of him. So it demonstrates not only the power of social media to get a message out there, but it shows how it can be an agent to help, the message coalesce and, the people who are ostensibly fans kind of turned on him here. So that's what I think is the peculiar aspect of this story, not just the tweet itself or the incidents on Twitter themselves.
Yeah, the other thing, this is sort of a cautionary tale, obviously, for what you do on a social media site, but apparently he tried to remedy things by first locking down his account, deleting those tweets, etc., but they lived on long enough for Mashable to reprint them verbatim and other sites, and so I guess it just goes to show that once it's out there, and you're not going to be able to cover your tracks.
Yeah.
So let's see. Why don't you tell us, Evan, what Rupert Murdoch has been up to lately?
Well, he's gotten some attention. I mean, you know, it's not unusual for Rupert Murdoch to be getting attention, but I guess there was this article it was an interview down in Australia earlier in the week where it was a long interview about, you know, it was over 90 minutes, but the thing that everybody's talking about in it is how, in connection with this, with moving News Corp and all of its properties behind a walled garden kind of setup where it's all paid content, where you actually have to pay to see the content. He's also said that part of that, he would not, as part of that, he wouldn't rule out taking the content out of the Google index, not having it available by Google. And in fact, he went so far as to say that he would challenge the fair use rights that a search engine like Google would have if they were to assert that indexing the content in a search engine was protected by fair use. So it's that whole notion, that whole conversation that he had in that interview down in Australia has there's kind of been some spin-off, interesting little discussion about what would the merits of a fair use defense be in the situation where the content owner puts their stuff behind a walled garden in a pay for access model, and also takes actions affirmatively to remove the content from the Google index from the database there. And I spent a little bit of time pondering and comparing the situation that Rupert Murdoch visualizes and talks about here with the 2006 opinion called Field versus Google. And that's the case that came from the District of Nevada. And one of the issues in that case is whether or not Google infringed the plaintiff's copyright when it made a copy of its content and placed it in the index. That I think the plaintiff wrote some short stories. And if I remember correctly, Mr. Field was an attorney himself. And the facts seem to indicate that he manufactured the litigation, put this content on specifically so that Google could index it and he could claim infringement. And long story short, the court held that, yes, that could be an infringement, but it was okay because it was a fair use and it gave, nice treatment to, those four fair use factors. Probably the most interesting one and the one most, worthy of comparison to Rupert Murdoch's situation was the fourth fair use factor, which looks to the effect on the market of the original copyrighted work. And in that case, the court found that there was no market for these short stories that Plaintiff Field was putting online. Whereas in the situation with Rupert Murdoch, he's being very vociferous and very, very high profile in saying that we are going to have this walled garden model. And he says that he actually wants fewer people seeing the content as long as there are more people paying for it. So that's the point on which the best case I think that we have on the books right now, Field versus Google, could differ from Rupert Murdoch's situation, which leads to the conclusion that Rupert Murdoch probably would have a decent chance, as strange as it sounds to be saying this, he would have a decent argument that a fair use defense on the part of the search engine may not be successful if he establishes this directly monetizing walled garden approach to content. So it's an interesting little academic spin and hypothetical examination of a situation with Rupert Murdoch raising his head and making waves, so to speak, on this business model of his.
Denise, if I could chime in real quick, I think this is a great example of how the fair use doctrine is really a gray area. I mean, there's no bright lines in fair use. And we get asked as lawyers and on panels and elsewhere all the time, well, if I'm using 30 seconds of a song, isn't that okay? That's what iTunes does. And, people have all of these misconceptions. And I think this is a great example where that fourth factor really can change as economies change, as technology changes, as markets change. And another case where this kind of shift, happened essentially was with the Kelly v. Ariba and the thumbnails. So Kelly v. Ariba was a case where the question was whether thumbnail copies that are being displayed online of images were infringing. And the court found that the thumbnail, there was no market for these thumbnail images. They're low quality. There's no way to really monetize that. Or at that time, there hadn't been, and the plaintiff in that case hadn't come up with any examples or arguments around that. And today, or more recently, there was an opinion in one of the Perfect 10 cases, I think it was, where the court said, this has changed a little. We now have a market, a potential market, at least there's an argument about it, for cell phone images of, in that case, it was sexually explicit content and things like that. But the market existed because now we're using our cell phones, and now that the thumbnail size is something that is reasonable to be considered perhaps marketable. And so that change in the economy really affected how the court analyzed that fourth factor. And it's possible here that Rupert Murdoch is focusing the public's attention on that, as well as potentially gearing up for a legal fight about that question.
Yeah, I don't quite understand what his original beef was. I mean, is it the case now that things on the Wall Street Journal are being indexed by Google, even though it is completely protected and behind a paywall?
Well, I think it's not. I don't know that his complaint is necessarily with the full text of the articles, but even just small, headlines and the lead into the story. And, you know, we're talking about more than Wall Street Journal too here. We're talking about, you know, a pretty broad set of properties here under the News Corp umbrella. I don't know where MySpace, you know, what that's supposed to mean.
Right.
But, clearly here, let me say one thing. I don't know if Rupert Murdoch, sometimes when you hear him talk, he sounds a little bit like me because you don't know if he's actually thought through what he's getting ready to say. there's clearly more going on here than than just this copyright issue. You know, he's making these statements about Google because he wants to draw attention to the model, and I think that it's clearly an example where there's a little bit of drama going on here, and a little bit of hyperbole, perhaps, if you look at it in the general sense of what his aim here is in talking about this. You know, the popular sentiment seems to be that there's great opposition to this notion of putting content behind a wall where you have to pay to get to it. It seems very counterintuitive given the broader way that content is distributed now, and there's, you know, more of an emphasis on user-generated content. So clearly, as him being an executive in the mainstream media, big media, you know, for more than 50 years now, going on 60 years, he has a certain interest and a certain automatic way of viewing this old business model, or the former business model, or the traditional business model, however you want to characterize it, that he's very entrenched as an incumbent. And so as things move away from that, and we see that traditional model in its death throes, perhaps, there's clearly going to be a lot of stuff thrown out there to make it provocative as it's perhaps going down in flames. Who knows?
Well, it seems like the model that Murdoch is describing is one that he's very proud to have, you know, in his stable with the Wall Street Journal, which is sort of the poster child for something that never made its content free and managed to survive into the networked internet age. And now we hear people like the New York Times rethinking their model. And just the other day, I was really surprised to see Ars Technica, which is clearly a new world, new media news site, offering premium, and I think it's for pay content. That's the first time I've seen that there. So it seems to me to be a model that is still relevant, perhaps more relevant as the recession drags on. And so this question of how it's going to get indexed and searched, if at all, is particularly front and center. So, you know, I understand.
The obvious criticism of what Rupert Murdoch wants to do is, you know, how on earth do you expect people to find the content in the first place if they're not going to, if it's not going to be on Google? You know, that's the first stop, obviously, for so many people. And you know, his posture in this interview was that, you know, that's fine with him. You know, I'm paraphrasing and kind of summarizing and generalizing what he said, but, you know, he's fine with having fewer eyeballs on the content as long as it's directly being monetized. And you know, for so many of us who are seeing it in a different way, and the, you know, the functioning of the web and the components that make the system operate and all the various factors that go into it to see these overall principles emerge, just seems really counterintuitive to us bloggers, I guess, maybe is one way of just stating it simply.
Yep. Another thing that bloggers like to do, particularly those of us who are lawyers, is report on what goes on in the legal realm. And oftentimes that happens in courtrooms. And, you know, I've certainly sat in a courtroom where my cell phone or other electronic device was required to be left outside and taken furious notes of the proceedings, knowing that I was going to blog them later. That seems a step removed from what people would really like to do, which is sit inside a courtroom and blog or tweet away with whatever resources they have available to them. We had a case come out this last week where a federal court has actually held that tweeting from a courtroom is in violation of the federal rules of criminal procedure, which restrict any sort of broadcast from a courtroom. So I guess this is the first time I've seen anyway of a court actually equating tweeting with broadcasting under this section. And, you know, it's just another example of courts trying to control media coverage of events that happen there. Colette, have you run into this sort of thing in your practice? Oh, you're on mute, hon.
Sorry, we had a little fire truck go by and then I forget. Yeah, a little bit. Not directly on any of the cases I've worked on. I haven't had any problems where we had problems with counsel or parties tweeting. But there was just a week ago, or a week and a half ago, a really interesting conference at the court here in the Northern District, the Ninth Circuit Media Conference, they called it. And there were two panels, you know, Chief Judge Von Walker introduced the program, and Judge Ilston was on one of the panels, and Judge Fogel was on another, and they were talking about this issue and this concern about the courts being open and, you know, accessible to the public and how you handle cases where you have extreme media attention. Like Judge Ilston is dealing with the Barry Bonds trial and, you know, trying to deal with too many reporters who want to be in the room and having overflow space. And you know, if you're actually capturing the content of the trial or the hearings and then transmitting it to a second room on a closed circuit, that's not considered broadcasting under their view. But then, if you think about it, why not just make that feed available publicly? I mean, it's a public trial. And so there's some pressure around that question. And they really are. I mean, I think in this jurisdiction, in the Ninth Circuit, and certainly in California, we're pretty forward-thinking or trying to deal with these kind of technical and public interest view issues. And I'm really intrigued that the court's taking it on to try and come up with plans. The sort of case that shall not be named, which is how it came up during the programs, was the, you know, the circus that can result when you have, you know, everything being distributed on TV or wherever on the internet, and it turns into sort of a circus, and people's rights are then in jeopardy, and can you get a fair jury, and there's a lot of concerns that way, and that, you know, there was definitely some allusion to the O.J. Simpson trial and all of the lessons that were learned there. So yeah, to answer your question, it hasn't come up for me in any specific manner in my cases, but I think that the courts are really having to pay attention to this. And the other funny or interesting thing to me was that I didn't know this except for through some comments that were made at the conference. Apparently, Justice Roberts is somewhat in favor of or not opposed to, you know, broadcasting or publishing the, you know, video of the Supreme Court proceedings, or making it more, maybe it's just recording. I don't know if video is considered in there, but, you know, he seems to be not really opposed to the concept, which is, I think, a shift with this Supreme Court. And I think if the Supreme Court is heading in that direction, I think the circuits and the district courts will probably feel more inclined to explore options that way.
Hey, I want to hear more about that Ninth Circuit media conference, because I think that's really interesting. But speaking of interesting things you can do with your phone, we have a special guest joining us on this week's Twill, and it's Leo Laporte. Leo, are you there?
Hi, Denise. Yeah. I'm on,
hey, Leo.
I'm on my cell phone. I hope you can hear me okay.
We can.
I'm on my Ford Sync, of course. And a couple, I've been listening for a while. A couple of things I was thinking were interesting. First of all, can't we already listen to audio Supreme Court arguments? I've been listening to that great site, Oye, Oye, for some time, and that's really remarkable.
Yes, absolutely. Those, unfortunately, are not live or anywhere near real time. They come out a good deal after the actual argument occurred.
I know here in the Seventh Circuit, we have pretty quick turnaround for audio. Actually, for several years, I'd say probably maybe 2006, the audio of the oral arguments, it goes up and there's actually a feed and everything else. So I'm proud of the Seventh Circuit, here in Chicago, being pretty innovative. Not real time, but, only a short lapse thereafter.
Is it just a tradition that the courts are, that the trials are public, or is that encapsulated in law?
It's definitely encapsulated in law. I mean, there's several different factors. One is the defendant's right to a fair trial. Another one is the integrity of the proceedings because, for example, you don't want witnesses who are getting ready to testify who would have been excluded from the proceeding because they aren't allowed to hear so that their testimony isn't tainted, so they wait outside. And what if they could overhear a broadcast of the proceeding? Then effectively that cloak would have been removed. And so judges, are very wary about guarding the integrity of the proceeding. That's one thing. And then judges, as a general rule, don't like the media circus that kind of descends upon broadcast trials.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, you look at what happened with OJ and other well-known broadcast trials. Anyway, I don't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to do an ad for Ford Sync. As long as I'm talking, I am not pulling a Maria Shriver here, by the way. I am doing this completely hands-free. In fact, the phone I'm using is a phone of Ford. One of the neat things about Ford Sync is you can have up to 25 different phones on the Bluetooth, so you get in the car and it's hands-free. I pressed a button on the steering wheel and it said dial, and I dialed the number. I gave out the number numerically, and it dialed, and it's great. I never take my hands off the road. I'm just a big fan of this. Ford said they wanted to do the ads, and I said, well, I better get a Ford then. So I went out and I got a Mustang with a Sync, and this thing is awesome. Well, my GPS is kicking it. Tell me I got to turn here. It does that too, by the way. Even if you don't have a screen, if you don't buy the full GPS, you get turn-by-turn directions with Ford Sync. They'll do the navigation for you. You can have built-in route check traffic for you. It'll tell you if there's bad traffic on the route, which is really cool. It uses the Sirius traffic service for that. It's just an amazing thing. You get 3 years of free service, too. So people ask me, the traffic, is a subscription thing after 3 years, but I think it's only $7 a month after 3 years. I'm just a big fan. I gotta make another turn here. it's great that I could do this while I'm in the car. And I thought it'd be kind of fun to do a Ford Sync ad while I'm actually using Ford Sync. So there's one last thing I'll say. I'll let you get back to your conversation. Is that if you want to know more about Ford Sync, you go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com. It's SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And actually, they're giving away 15 free Nanos or Zunes. If you use the Twitter hashtag #SyncMyRidePodcast, #SyncMyRidePodcast on Twitter. So just say, hey, I was listening to This Week in Law, and I love the show, and I want to win a free Nano or a Zoom. They're giving away 15 through December 8th, and they're giving away one a day. Can you hear the Harley that's going by me?
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, I'll let you get back to your conversation.
Before you go, Leo, did you know that there are 18 states and working on being more that have hands-free laws, including our own California?
Well, this will also reach you SMS messages. It'll reach your text messages as they come in. And if you have a text message-enabled phone, and more are able to do this, you get some pre-canned messages you can send back. My favorite one is why, W-H-Y, ? And as somebody with teenagers, I think that's one I'll be using a lot.
Well, I think you want your teenagers behind the wheel of that car, much as it's a brand new Mustang.
I'm not driving this car. This is mine, baby.
Well, thank you so much, Leo, and we're thrilled to have the sponsor.
Yay, Ford. Go Ford. Everybody's
Go tweet. Ford.
Sweet Pound Take My Ride podcast that you heard it on Twill.
All right.
Right on.
Thanks,
right.
Leo.
See you later.
Take care.
See you, Leo.
All right, so
that was nice, and it was either meta or it was self-referential or something, you know.
Well, it's going to get more so because we have this great story about hands-free laws and what they enable police officers to do or not if you're stopped. But I do want to wrap up this notion of media coverage of court proceedings. And just ask Colette, since you were there hearing the Ninth Circuit, one of our, the largest of our federal circuits, chatting about this and how they're going to manage it. Do you see any movement toward acknowledging that technology's changed the playing field a bit? Are you there, Colette?
Colette. Muting, sorry.
Okay.
Oh, that's all right. I think this is one of these days I'll figure this out. I think this is definitely going to be reviewed. And one of the most interesting things about the program was thinking about the process by which the court rules are created. And, you know, there's the judicial conference, and this is stuff I didn't really know about before. You know, I hadn't really stopped to think about before. I mean, we get our rules, we know what they are, we apply them in our cases and move on. But the rules are administrative rules effectively, and they will be reviewing them from time to time, and they should be seeking public comment. And I think they're much more likely than in the next review, which I believe will be forthcoming, to be looking at this issue and revising what the rules say. And those rules, when they become usually during the process of rulemaking, you know, the public can comment. And then also after a final rule is created, there can be, you know, public comment and appeal and everything. So given how media has changed and how we have lots of bloggers covering law and court cases and lots of journalists who are also very interested in using the media this way, I think they'll be much more plugged in on the process of the rulemaking and speaking about the technology and how it can facilitate, you know, opening the courts to the public. And so I'm very curious how that process may go as this definition of what a broadcast is worked out. And I have to say, Judge Ilston made a very compelling comment that was really kind of nice to hear, which was when she was a young lawyer, I think, or maybe she was on the bench already, but she said that somebody had given her copies of a book about the Supreme Court with audio tapes that came with it. It may have been a book that I have, which is called May It Please the Court. And it, you know, it's nothing new these days, but she said that those audio tapes of these oral arguments was very inspiring to her, and very sort of meaningful to listen to these, you know, major cases that have been selected, you know, for inclusion in this book. And the comment she was making is that by opening the courts and allowing, you know, all of the kinds of arguments that that are made, you know, they're not all Supreme Court exciting, deep, juicy arguments. I mean, some of them can be very mundane and people might get bored, but making that stuff available on a very timely and quick basis could be really inspiring to young lawyers, to people contemplating the law, to people thinking about practicing, and can really shed light on what the profession is really like and what's going on in this branch of our government.
You know, even in the absence of new regulations or a review of the rules or whatever to make changes to keep pace with technology, I think there's an interesting potential First Amendment issue here, because clearly a restriction on the dissemination of this information is a restriction on speech. And, you know, absent, you know, if it's not a, you know, if it's not disruptive to the actual judicial process, which, you know, most of the time sitting there putting out a tweet is not going to be so loud or so distracting as to, you know, disrupt the court proceedings. It really seems to me, you know, putting a blanket prohibition on that in the form of interpreting the word broadcast in there to prohibit this kind of distribution of information seems pretty overly broad. You know, we've got to look at, you know, the breadth of the restriction, and does that meet a, you know, a compelling state interest? So, you know, I think that one would have a pretty good First Amendment argument if you're subject, you know, seeing that the application of this rule in this way could be a violation of one's First Amendment rights to speak freely about what's going on in the courtroom, which, you know, even in those mundane situations that you're talking about, Colette, there's a very important interest in being able to talk about that.
Sure. And yeah, there's go ahead.
Go ahead. Finish up.
I was just going to say there's also the press's right in this. I mean, the First Amendment covers freedom of speech and of the press. So, you know, there's a hidden issue potentially about whether someone blogging about a case or blogging in court is the press, and should they be able to have access? What's the access that the press should have? And should they be able to report, and how quickly, on these things? And one of the reporters in the room at this conference said, well, this isn't that different from when we first got cell phones, or when phones were added to the courts to begin with, like, you know, pay phones. You know, they used to sit in the courtroom waiting for the ruling, and then they'd run out to the pay phone and dial their editor or somebody back at the paper, and the paper would, you know, type up the story and get it in the presses. So it's the same thing. It's just faster and quicker and more direct. And so the question is, does the speed matter? I think on some level.
Yeah, I think they have an issue there with the perennial who is a journalist question. And right. Also, getting back to the language of the rule, the what is a broadcast question? Because, you know, obviously a tweet is further down the continuum toward that than something like an email, but an email could certainly be used to make court proceedings pretty public as well, or a wave, or, you know, anything else that is available to us today and could be accessed from something small and portable and wireless. So I do think that it's an interesting thing to have had a court come down on the side that a tweet is a broadcast. And I don't know that I guess folks might not have too much trouble agreeing with that. But the real question is, you know, so what is that?
I think the real reason that courts don't like these things, and I mean, I say this as somebody who clerked for a judge and knows a lot of judges, I think there's, in judicial DNA is, at least the current, you know, crop of judges are very biased against allowing cameras, allowing any kind of immediate broadcast of any type to take place, because they're just not sure how that can cause problems for them. You know, as I said earlier, I mean, even in a civil trial, there are frequently sequestration orders entered, and witnesses are told, you know, until you testify, you can't sit in the courtroom. So everybody has to clear out. And I've been involved in a lot of cases where there's a dispute in the middle of the trial about whether one witness talked to another, and judges hate that because they have to take time out of the trial to do a fact-finding mission to figure out what was heard, how that impacted the proceeding. And so they're very jealous about trying to protect the integrity of the proceeding, which I understand. So that's one part of it. The other part is just the dignity of the proceedings, which, of course, the OJ case is the shining example of how everything can unravel. And you know, every judge I've ever talked to about cameras in the courtroom always uses that as the example of why it shouldn't be allowed. And so I think there's a deep-seated prejudice on the part of judges to allowing it. Now, you know, by the same token, to me, it seems pretty clear that inevitably we're going to have a lot more cameras in the courtroom and things like Twitter, you know, and you're just not going to be able to contain that viral force, you know. And getting back to what Colette said, one of the things I think that would be really useful is if court proceedings were transmitted, you know, a couple of things would happen. One, you know, you might be able to see that, at least in certain courts, you know, the judge is sleeping or not paying attention, or, you know, is mistreating the lawyers. That wouldn't be good for the judges. But what would be good for attorneys is the ability to see how the judge manages their courtroom. I mean, to me, you know, one of the biggest things I want to know if I have a case is, you know, which judge was it assigned to? And then if I don't know the judge, I start trying to find out what that judge's, you know, mannerisms are, how they handle things and so forth. And if I could tune in and just watch a proceeding without having to leave the office, that would be hugely valuable to me. And in this day where oral arguments are frequently, well, are not frequently granted, at least in the federal courts where I practice around Louisiana. That's no longer the norm. You know, when I was a young lawyer, it was the norm that you would have oral arguments. So you had the opportunity to observe oral argument, and that was huge. I mean, that's how you learn. You know, you're sitting there waiting to argue your case, and you're watching the other lawyers, and you're finding out what sort of judge this is and what, you know, kind of arguments they like and so forth. That's a huge advantage. And you don't get that anymore because there aren't oral arguments, so you don't get to sit in court if you're a young lawyer. And how would you learn? You know, so I think it would be useful to have these things broadcast. And I think over time, that's what's going to happen. I just think that right now, most of the judges who came up through the ranks, they don't like it. And they're very suspicious, and they just don't want to allow it to happen.
Well, Colette, sort of along these lines, you sent us a site from the ABA Standing Committee on Federal Judicial Improvements that is aimed at assisting media coverage of trials, not in real time and not in a broadcast kind of fashion. But you want to tell us what this new site allows people to do?
It was briefly described and announced, but I don't think it's actually running yet, but the link, I think, will explain a little bit about what's going on. The gist is that the ABA is trying to select, important cases and have them available promptly over the ABA.net website. And there's a lot of people behind kind of culling what cases get published there and opinions so that you have more ready access to important opinions. I believe right now it's going to be appellate courts only. But I apologize, I don't know much more than what was provided in the website. And I'm sure that the ABA will be linking and making, you know, a bigger production of the release of this new service. And it's really
what Howard Bashman and other appellate bloggers have been doing for a while, but they're going to come in and put the ABA's imprimatur on it and also give some law professors a platform to spread their analyses of these cases. So I mean, I think it's a great thing, you know, the more information and analysis that are available, the better. But it does make me kind of laugh that, you know, is there a shortage of analyses of yeah. new and noteworthy cases coming out? Maybe there's not, but maybe there is no real centralized way of quickly accessing those analyses. So this will be a nice resource to have. It's called Media Alerts on Federal Courts of Appeals. And I think they're going to try and keep folks up to date on what the ABA considers noteworthy decisions and try and unpack them for people, because obviously that's not the easiest thing in the world to do when an 80-page opinion comes out and you're trying to figure out what all of its ramifications are. So thank you, ABA, and thank you, Colette, for letting us know about that. Getting back to Leo cruising around in his Mustang and those 18 states with hands-free laws. We have an interesting story here about, of course, not texting and driving under those laws, but what happens if you are stopped for that kind of a violation and the officer decides this is a good opportunity to just check out your cell phone and see what sort of information he or she can glean from that. Anyone think there would be a problem with that kind of practice? Ernie? Now you're on mute.
Sorry, I pulled a Colette. it would be a Fourth Amendment unreasonable search, probably. But, you know, it does raise an interesting question, because let's say, you know, you're pulled over for texting or for making a phone call. You know, of course, the proof as to whether you were texting or not would be sitting right there if the police officer could just access it. So, you know, they would take the position that it's part, you know, of a, you know, reasonable search, and you would say it isn't. But let me give you the first practical tip. Enable the code lock for your cell phone, and just don't give them the code lock.
So hand over your phone, but they can't do anything to it?
Yeah, that you want a good practical solution. The Fourth Amendment is all well and good, but that you don't want to have to be facing a motion to suppress. You'd rather have them trying to get the information from you. So I would say, you know, lock your cell phone and, you know, or don't give it to them, or toss it under your chair, or, you know, whatever you have to do. But don't make it easy for them to grab it.
Essentially what you're saying is don't consent to the search, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is it's just a really interesting situation, and I think we kind of touched on this on an earlier episode, but it really is it forces us, or it makes us think about this notion of a couple of Fourth Amendment notions here in a new way. You know, what is a search that's incident to an arrest, perhaps? I mean, you know, it could be brought under that doctrine. Or, you know, what is it that's in plain view, you know, when you're doing the search? And then finally, what is the scope of the warrantless search to begin with? And did it go beyond what was necessary in looking for the evidence that, you know, pertains to the crime that there may or may not be reasonable suspicion or probable cause to be investigating in the first place? And so those principles stated in a general or an abstract way could play out in interesting ways, you know, when we're talking about the actual situation where you're being pulled over. Ernie raises a great point in just making sure that your phone is password protected. Then the interesting inquiry would be, say that they can access it, because if you haven't done that or not, it seems to me that the search would have to be limited to investigating whether you were actually using the phone within the past few minutes, you know, because that's the evidence that is reasonably related to the crime that is suspected here. I don't think that even if the cops were to look at the phone and investigate, you know, its use in the moments immediately preceding the traffic stop, I think it would be a clear Fourth Amendment violation for them to go and start exploring the directory structure or whatever, looking for, you know, images and stuff like that. I know that there was I'm reminded now of the way that we were talking about this before in an earlier episode. Was there was an interesting case out of Kansas a couple weeks ago. In the past week, there was a trial on it. There was a motion for summary judgment order entered a few weeks ago that I wrote about on my blog, but there was a trial. The issue was whether or not it was an invasion of privacy for there to be, for the cops to look at, to confiscate the phone and then take the those images and share them with the other cops and perhaps otherwise distribute them. The issue in the case was whether or not that there was a Section 1983 violation there. And so this is certainly an issue that, is full of wonderful law school, you know, exam kind of things dealing with the Fourth Amendment and where the reasonable boundaries are in an intangible space like the way the bits are stored on a cell phone. Really interesting.
Yeah, what comes to mind for me is that, you know, when you're pulled over for another kind of traffic stop, the officers are limited to gathering their evidence against you from the equipment they have available, you know, their radar or what have you, and their own observations, you know, if they think you're speeding. And here, if someone were trying to look at your phone and gather the evidence that you were actually on it, you know, I think that would be an unconventional step forward from how a traffic stop ordinarily goes. I would certainly object if someone were to make that request of me on a stop and I were denying that I'd been on the phone. I would say, look, you know, if issue me the ticket, if I want to contest it, I'll come in and show you the phone that demonstrates that I wasn't doing what you contend I was.
That raises an interesting point, though, because there's mm-hmm. exigent circumstances. You know, exigent circumstances can justify a warrantless search, and one of the things that could justify it being called an exigent circumstance is the likelihood that evidence will be destroyed. You know, think of it in like a drug case. You know, what's the likelihood that the accused or the guy, you know, is going to swallow the bag of heroin or you know, throw the bottle out the window or whatever. So, you know, it's tricky there. If you're going to say, well, I'll show up in court a week and a half later, then it becomes, I guess, an electronic discovery issue, you know, forensics and all that stuff. What was on the phone in those minutes? So,
right. Unless you swallow it.
Good point.
In which case, it's an entirely different kind of discovery.
Right, right.
We have a comment in the Wave asking about whether the police couldn't use their own powers to subpoena, I guess, or obtain through the phone company information about the use of the phone at the time specified. So I agree. I mean, that's a more difficult, time-consuming way of getting to the facts, but maybe that would avoid the Fourth Amendment unreasonable search issue.
Right. Yeah, certainly not the same issue. Certainly not the same expectation of privacy in those records that are in the offices and on the network and the system of the phone company. That's for sure.
Right. Looks like Ernie has a comment too.
Oh, you want me? Well, yeah, my comment was just that, I mean, I think as a practical matter, it would be hard for the police. I mean, what the commenter was saying was, why don't the police first ask you for your phone number and then call it, or have their own people back at the station call it, or find out through back channels whether you were on the phone? And as a practical matter, well, first of all, you know, there's the phone. It's sitting right there. It's next to you. They can be pretty sure it's your phone, unless you're in the car with somebody else. So making them go through that extra step isn't always going to be necessary. And if you are in the car with somebody else, and let's say you're in the car with a lot of somebody else's, I mean, what's to stop you from lying about your phone number to throw them off the trail? And of course, cops are familiar with people lying with them, so they would be disinclined in a lot of cases to rely on that or want to go through that step. And then lastly, verifying by going through the back channel would be difficult, because it's not like the police just get on the phone and call the, you know, your cell phone company and say, hey, you know, give us some information. They'd need a subpoena. It would be a lot harder for them to get that information. They certainly couldn't get it while the police were there, you know, holding you by the roadside. So not to say that the police are always doing their job, but that would be making them jump through a lot more hoops than they're likely to want to have to jump through, or that they should have to jump through.
Hey, folks, I'm getting the word from Twit Central up in Petaluma that we have Futures in Biotech coming up today. So we're going to have an earlier show stop than usual, but the rest of the links that we have that we are not able to cover today, we're going to get to next week for sure. And we're not going to stop just yet. We have a few 10 or 15 minutes left of the show. More like 20, actually. I'm looking at the clock. So I just wanted to let you know that in advance, and also take a break and insert our ad and thanks to Audible.com, our other sponsor of the show. Last night, I finally got around to seeing the Frost Nixon interview movie. Have you guys seen that one?
No, I haven't seen but it does look good.
I didn't see that yet.
It's wonderful, and you know, I'd heard great things about it, but I'm really glad that I finally got the chance to watch it. And one of the main characters in the movie, it's such an interesting approach to a movie, because it's a fictional documentary, and the only time I've ever seen that done successfully before is in a humorous context. You know, thinking of This Is Spinal Tap or Best in Show, a documentary where people are being interviewed, but they're really actors. And the Frost Nixon movie is done that way. And the guy who is sort of the pot stirrer, really wanting to go after Nixon, is James Reston. And he has a book on Audible called The Conviction of Richard Nixon, The Untold Story of the Frost Nixon Interviews, that is 5 hours and 40 minutes long, unabridged. And I'm definitely going to download this one, having seen that movie, because the James Reston character in the film was by far the most interesting and provocative, other than the two main players, Frost and Nixon themselves. So he was an insider who was a journalist in D.C. and David Frost's Watergate advisor, and was digging up information basically even further damning Nixon as they were prepping for the interview. And I guess on the very last day of the interviews, we were all pretty young when this happened, but on the very last day of the interview when they had the Watergate session, Frost really got him with some of these things and got him to sort of break down and admit that he had done some things to the American people that he wasn't proud of, which he'd never really been able to bring himself to do before that time. So very fascinating story. The Conviction of Richard Nixon on audible.com is our pick for this week. Thank you so much, Audible. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you can get this book for free and sign up for the 14-day free trial of the Audible Gold Listener Program, and you'll only be charged $14.95 a month thereafter. You get a credit for a free book in each one of those months, and we try and give you suggestions for how to use that credits every week here on the show. So thanks again, Audible, and we appreciate your support. So I think we have time to get to at least one more of our stories, and the one I wanted to round out with, if we could, is this story from Boing Boing that comes as no surprise to me at all, that a law firm is marketing itself as an expert in how to unmask anonymous posters, how to pierce somebody's anonymity on the web. And they have, you know, a team of lawyers that are aimed at this problem. I'm trying to find the link right now. Where is it exactly? Here we go.
Fourth
corporate
one
law firm, yeah. Corporate law firm targets whistleblowers and anonymous commenters. A British corporate law firm has created a new unit that will help easily offended corporate giants track down and sue anonymous internet forum posters. And, you know, I'm sure that much as we might laugh at the strategy here, I'm sure we're all guilty of it in one way or another. We're all lawyers and we're trained to look at things as problems and foresee the fear that can be involved. And so oftentimes law firms will create units or groups and market them designed to address those problems. So here they've gone to this issue of that it's difficult sometimes to find out who has done a wrongful or unlawful act online, and their little unit there is existing to pierce that. Now, Colette, I know that you you have had some cases and some instances where you have needed to go after anonymous posters. Do you think that it makes sense to specialize in that kind of talent?
I don't know. I mean, it's something you need to have in your quiver. What's the saying?
Arrows
and quivers. Repertoire. I mean, you need to know how to do this if you're trying to represent people who are defamed or their privacy rights are violated by the posting of a third party. And the steps to do that are not that unknown. I mean, not that scientific. You have to do all these things. You have to file a lawsuit, you have to serve a subpoena, and then you have to hope that the company you're subpoenaing has the records and is cooperative.
And that John Doe doesn't intervene.
Right. Well, it would be convenient if John Doe doesn't intervene. But, you know, most of the companies who are in this position to receive these subpoenas will, I shouldn't say most, the ones I'm familiar with, Yahoo, Google, those kind of companies will notify the user typically and allow them an opportunity to jump in and get representation. You know, there are some techniques and there are things you can do without going through all of that to investigate. A very good private investigator sometimes can figure out who the anonymous speaker is without having to jump through legal hoops to go there. I mean, then there are a lot of people looking to specialize in that kind of skill, you know, analyzing the writing and comparing it to other writing elsewhere. And, you know, it's very, I think, kind of fact specific. So, you know, and I'd be really impressed if these people have a highly successful track record, because sometimes you can't really determine who it is in the end. You can figure out an IP address, but that could be at a cafe and you don't know who was using the computer at that time, or, you know, the IP address can change depending on what the person, what kind of technology the person's using. So, you know, I'd be, if, are they, I thought they were overseas. I mean, if they're a U.S. firm, you know, they're going to be subject to ethical obligations, and they can't promise results and things like that in most, you know, under most ethical rules in most states. But, you know, I think as more and more and more people are going online and discovering information about them that they didn't know was there and that may not be true and that they're harmed by or whatever, this area of the law, you're going to see more activity in this area. And if they can come up with a cost-effective solution for people, that's possibly a good way to go. I mean, it's not a bad niche, I would say, but I think it's, I would be bored if that's all I did with my practice. You know, I like the variety of, you know, having some of those cases, doing some other stuff. And, you know, I think there's also a danger here, actually, and this is an important thing. I'd be very interested in your all feedback on this. You know, a lot of the people that I've spoken to, you know, not, and many of whom don't materialize into a real case, their main goal is just to figure out who said the thing. They don't really want to bring a whole lawsuit. They don't want to bring it all the way through to judgment, but they just want to know the information. And I think this is true also, like if we remember that case in New York about the skank comment, it really felt like what was really being determined and what really the plaintiff wanted there was the identity of this person who made the allegedly defamatory comments. And that's not a typical remedy. That's not the remedy that comes for a defamation case. You know, it's not like, you know, unclothing the speaker is the purpose behind defamation law. There's other purposes. So I think it's an interesting area, and I get caught on both sides because I want to help these people. And of course, the trauma and the emotional stress that comes with this kind of event sometimes, you know, knowing who it is and getting that information sometimes is very helpful to the person getting over the drama and the experience. And so, and in one of the cases I was consulting on, you know, it was never filed, but it involved a student, and the school, for example, couldn't enforce its own school policies because they didn't know what other student was making the comments. It was a Facebook kind of thing. And so the school was really hard pressed to enforce its own anti-cyberbullying rules because the anonymity of the students who were making the comments. So, you know, there's some interesting things that happen, but just unclothing the person isn't really the purpose behind these laws. And so I see a conflict in what people really want and what the law actually forces you to go and do.
You make a very good point about, you know, what I would characterize as the catharsis that an aggrieved party may feel in at least taking efforts to find out who it is that is, you know, dragging them through the mud online. And on that point, you know, of this whole notion that you're raising, Colette, that it's not the purpose of these procedures, and it's not the purpose of defamation law to just unmask somebody who is speaking poorly about you. That is a very interesting point, and that's a very important principle underlying the jurisprudence that has developed, at least in this country. I can't speak for how the jurisprudence has developed in this area in England, where this law firm's operating. But it clearly is, generally what the courts do, as we know, we've talked about this before, when a plaintiff comes to court wanting to unmask an anonymous speaker, and I know there was a case in Chicago that's also in our list of links here, whenever the plaintiff comes, the courts are reluctant to order that the anonymous defendant be unmasked without a significant showing that it's likely that there's a good case, that there's at least a prima facie defamation case that's been pled, to avoid this very problem that you're talking about, Colette, of the plaintiff coming and essentially declaring victory at you know, before a complaint is even filed, or an amended complaint, you know, with the name of the party inserted into the caption is filed here, because that does violence to many of the principles that we hold dearly of being able to speak freely. You know, the principles underlying our First Amendment right to speak anonymously that we see from cases like, McIntyre versus Ohio Election Committee, and then everybody cites, you know, how the founding fathers wrote all these pamphlets, you know, under the names like Publius and all that stuff. So, looping back, like you, Colette, I would get pretty bored if that's all that I was constrained to think about all day. From what I gather, this is a big law firm over there in England. So you know that this was some magical idea that was put through committees and run through the marketing department. So there's that side of it as well. But it is a little bit unfortunate to see this mechanism that should, you know, have proper effect in the appropriate circumstance be pigeonholed in this way. And it's no secret that somebody like Cory Doctorow would pick up on it to put it on Boing Boing, to bring him up two weeks in a row.
Well, Ernie had a great tip earlier, and we are going to try and start incorporating a tip of the week and perhaps a resource of the week for you to take away from the show. Ernie's tip about not surrendering your phone if asked to on a hands-free kind of stop. A resource that would be related to this if you're looking to thwart any corporate law departments who are specializing in unveiling the identity of anonymous posters is a great guide that has been up at EFF for some time called How to Blog Safely About Work or Anything Else. And it is full of tips on how you can make it difficult for someone to unmask your identity online. So I encourage you to go there and check that out if you are concerned about keeping your perfectly lawful and non-defamatory and non-harassing and non-cyberbullying conduct.
Yeah. Thanks for that. thanks for that qualification on there, because yes. I know that EFF guy, they talk a lot of useful, you know, technical stuff like using Tor and all that stuff. But I would say I would amend, and you've adequately qualified it, but just to underscore it, the best way to avoid real trouble on this is don't defame anybody else in the first place. Maybe that's a good way of starting.
Right, and they have a nice list here of things that you might want to be cloaked behind anonymity and are perfectly lawful, like political opinions, unionizing, whistleblowing, reporting on your work for the government, legal off-duty activities, etc. So there are plenty of reasons why you might want to be anonymous, and the EFF has stepped in with this great guide about how to preserve that. And Evan has stepped in with reminding us all that there is this great tool out there called social media that we can be and should be using in connection with the show. So as
I kind of like that stuff. That's good stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's new. It's great. We got to try it out. Kick the tires. so we finally set up a Facebook fan page for Twill. You can find it at denise.howell.net/FB. And what we plan to do there and at Twill's Twitter account, which is at This Week in Law, is to go ahead and post questions before the show based on the links that we plan to discuss and get your feedback. And once we have it before the show, we can go ahead and talk about it while we're chatting. And of course, we have all our real-time interaction as well. So do check out those new social media additions to the show. And thanks so much, guys, for joining us once again. We'll see you next week on the 20th. You can find Ernie Svensson at ErnieTheAttorney.net and at ErnieAttorney on Twitter. Bye, Ernie. Have a great week.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here as always, and I look forward to seeing you guys next week.
Yes.
Bye, Ernie.
And Colette, thank you so much for joining us. Folks can find Colette at VogelLaw.com and at VogelLaw on Twitter.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a fun conversation.
As usual. And Evan, thanks so much too. And folks should also look for Evan over at CNN.com, where he's been contributing to their video bloggers group. Great conversations over there that are definitely in line with the kind of stuff that we do here. So thanks, Evan, for pointing me toward those.
Great. Thanks for mentioning it. That's a lot of fun. Oh, yeah, like you say, there's a lot of interesting topics. Usually it's on the Blogger Bunch segment. So all across the board when there are, you know, provocative issues coming up. So that's fun. Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, and when Evan's not punditizing for CNN, he's over at internetcases.com and also at internetcases on Twitter. So thanks all. We're looking forward to a fun show next Friday, the 20th, where I think that special guest Rick Clow is going to join us briefly.
All right, my buddy Rick.
Yes, he has some kind of clandestine announcement he wants to make that he won't tell me about yet. So we'll have to see what that is next week. Thanks, everyone.
Talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.